Good afternoon. The Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. It is Monday, February 6th. Thank you all so much for coming back. If you have a cell phone with you, if you would please turn it off. Even if it's on vibrate, it messes up the recording somehow. And all those people all over the world that want to know what we're doing here today, the sound gets messed up and then they're sad. And we really don't want anyone to be sad. We have one thing to make us all happy. We've got some special visitors today. We've got a number of youth from the Oregon Foster Youth Coalition, and we are so glad to have you all here today. We'll be hearing a lot from these folks and their colleagues in the months ahead, with the goal being that anything that we are doing related to foster care or foster youth, we're going to make sure that foster youth are at the table talking to us and weighing in on how that will impact their experience. So today we've got a couple of work sessions and a public hearing. We have just heard that the fiscal statement is not back yet on Senate Bill 243. So we are going to carry that over, that work session. We'll carry that over until Wednesday. But the amendments that you'll see posted in there are what we talked about. They're the same ones that were posted last week, with an addition that was your idea last February, Senator Olson.
Last February, which
was clarifying, and we were right at the end and there wasn't time. It was clarifying the definition of involuntary seclusion and making it clear that that is not time out and it does not include age-appropriate discipline, that that's a locked space.
I don't remember putting that amendment in, Madam Chair.
We ran out of time, but we talked about it at length.
No, I mean this time. I don't remember putting that in.
No, I did.
No.
So we now have it. So you'll see it on Wednesday, but those amendments are in OLIS. But we don't have Senator... I think we can go ahead and do these without Senator Dembrough. Are we okay on... Is everybody okay? All right, so we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 244.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 244 clarifies the Department of Human Services notification requirements regarding child caring agencies. It declares emergency and is effective on passage. There is a fiscal statement of no fiscal impact, a revenue statement of no revenue impact. There's also a dash one amendment where it primarily defines governmental agency and makes appropriate changes throughout the bill.
And the colleagues, that amendment, we heard from Doug about that a little bit. There was some language in there that went beyond the relating clause of the bill, so that was taken out. And the juvenile directors wanted to ensure that the juvenile directors are notified when it involves their kids. And I promised DHS that we would also put on the record that it is not intended to include things like fire marshals. What these notifications are talking about are places that actually impact the care of youth. So, Senator Olson, do you have a script?
It should be in your stack there, Senator.
In my stack?
Yes.
Is everybody happy with the amendments? I don't hear any complaints.
It should be underneath the...
I think it's here.
Yeah, it's underneath that one. It should be.
There you go.
Oh, bingo. Chair Gilser, I move to adopt the dash one amendment dated 2/1/2017.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 244. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the dash one amendment? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Olson?
Chair Gilser, I move Senate Bill 244 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 244 as amended with the dash one amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered, and our first bill moves out of the committee. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 244 and open a work session on Senate Bill 245.
Who's going to carry it?
I'll carry that one.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 245 clarifies the definition of child for the purposes of statutes governing child caring agencies. It modifies the definition of child caring agency to exclude facilities only serving persons over the age of 18 and facilities that require children to be accompanied by a guardian. Declares emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments to the measure, and there is a statement of no fiscal impact and a statement of no revenue impact.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Chair Gilster, I move Senate Bill 245 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 245 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, the bill passes the committee. Senator Knope, would you carry this one?
No, I'd be delighted.
Thanks. Okay, so Senator Knope will carry that one. We are on our way. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 245. And again, we're carrying the work session on Senate Bill 243 over to Wednesday. And I'm now going to open up a work session on the possible introduction of committee measures. And again, a vote for introduction is not a vote on the merits or on the content of a concept, nor does it guarantee the draft will be referred back to this committee or that it will ever receive a hearing.
Chair Gilster, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 3825, dated February 1st, 2017.
Senator Olson moves that LC 3825 be introduced as dated 2-1-2017 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And anybody else have committee bills for today? If you have them, we'll just continue having this spot here. Just send them on over and we'll get them in. Closing the work session on possible introduction of committee members on the possible introduction of committee measures. And I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 101.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 101 expands child abuse investigation authority to include interviews of subject children on private as well as public school grounds. It requires the Department of Human Services to notify parents and guardians unless the notification would compromise child safety.
Thank you. And we've got three folks signed up: Stacey Ayers from DHS, Katie Suver from the District Attorneys, and Amanda Dalton from our law enforcement folks. Come on up.
Go ahead and start, since I'm the one that introduced the bill originally, or the concept originally.
Sounds like a good idea.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, my name is Stacey Ayers. I am the manager of the Child Protective Services Program at DHS. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the bill. This is a concept that I originally had introduced several months ago, and there have been various iterations that you now see before you as the one of them that was put forward. The original concern that we had, and what we were trying to fix, the concern that has been raised by child abuse investigators in the field across the state, it's not isolated to any one particular area, is that workers who are responsible for conducting child abuse investigations pursuant to statute would go to schools and would be met with essentially an obstruction. And I think the schools were acting, I believe, with the intent to protect their children. But essentially what they were doing is blocking what was a legislatively mandated process from happening. And especially in private schools, the language in the bill used to read public school premises. And so the struggle, of course, was that private school personnel would look at this bill and say, you have no authority to be here, when clearly I believe the legislative intent for investigations is that they should be able to occur wherever the child is. And so there's language that's currently in the statute that talks about things like school administrator or school personnel being prevented from talking about the contents of an interview, for instance. And that implies, though, that they were actually there during the interview. And in many cases, they're not. Additionally, one of the struggles with this is it doesn't talk about the notice that they're receiving about the investigation. So law enforcement, DHS, they're there at the school notifying the school personnel, the administrator of the school, unless they're the subject of the investigation, that an investigation is occurring. And whether they're, I would argue that they're not in the investigation just because they've received notice of the investigation. And so we are, you have the bill in front of you, and it clearly talks about providing notification unless it would compromise child safety. And we've, as that has been out there and people have had a chance to look at it, there have been a lot of, I think, and rightfully so, lots of concerns raised by other entities, including law enforcement and the DA's office. And I'd just like to be really clear, it was never our intent to compromise investigations that any of the entities that I mentioned are involved in. I've had a number of conversations with Ms. Silver and also with the DA's Association and other in other capacities, and with a number of other DAs that represent other counties around the state. And just to try to clarify what exactly our intent was and what the concerns were, I believe there are some amendments that will need to be made to the bill to make it so it's viable for people. And I'll let the Katie and law enforcement talk about that, but just wanted to be really clear. This is what we would view as an attempt to make it clear that interviews need to be able to happen. It is our responsibility to notify, but we also don't want to compromise any investigation law enforcement's doing or that the DA's office is involved in. So,
thank you.
Good enough.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Katie Suber. I am a Marion County Deputy District Attorney, and included among my responsibilities are the assistance with law enforcement and prosecution of child abuse cases. So this particular statute is obviously very important for our purposes of being able to assist law enforcement with conducting child abuse investigations and breaking down any barriers which might prevent or impede those investigations from being done in a timely fashion. And what DHS and the DA's Association have been working on in the last few days is really identifying the goals of the Senate bill and how we can best work with each other and with law enforcement to come up with the most efficient language which accomplishes those goals. So we are still working on some language that would, number one, make it clear that this applies to children in any school in the state of Oregon, not simply public schools, but private, charter, whatever other designation there may be. And then secondly, that if an administrator or a school staff member has information that DHS and or law enforcement is interviewing a child, that that information does not get shared with any person, whether it be a parent or guardian of the child or family member. Unfortunately, the reality of child abuse investigations is that many of them occur within the same family or extended family. And what we have found is that, particularly in the initial stages of the investigation, it is imperative that only those who are tasked with conducting the investigation are aware that an investigation is being conducted. So I'm happy to answer any questions, if there are any, about specific language or other issues that may be on your mind regarding the Senate bill. But what I can tell you is that we all want to continue to work together to come up with the best language available.
And why don't we hear from Amanda, and then we'll come back and do questions at the end.
So, Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, Amanda Dalton, on behalf of the Oregon Council of Police Associations, we represent about 60 medium to small size law enforcement line officers across the state. Echo a lot of the comments you've heard Our officers are often the first kind of to go into the school and do the investigation. These types of investigations are very important. It's often the first opportunity to interview a child outside of the presence of the parents if that's necessary. What we found is in some of the school districts, there's been a request for information prior to the interview, an additional barrier that we think is not necessary. Kind of exposing information relevant to the investigation, which could include warrant attachments or exigent circumstances that may not always exist. And so excited to hear there's other opportunities for amendments and strengthen this bill, but thank you and look forward to supporting it.
Thank you. Are there questions for Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In reading this bill, the only concern I have, and it's a concern I brought up in one of the other bills that we had last week, it says on line 8 that school administrator or a school staff member designated by the administrator may, at the investigator's discretion, be present. I think that word needs to be changed to shall, to protect, so that there's another person in there to protect the child. Could you elaborate on that?
No, go ahead.
Well, I would only talk about Vice Chair Olson, Madam Secretary, or Madam Secretary.
Thank you for the question.
It's stuck in my head for some reason. So, Senator Gelser.
Indeed.
So, thank you for the question. I think that the concern that you have around, or that the department has around that, is if it is shall, you're still considering whether or not they're involved in it. And so the language right now is permissive, and I think that it's appropriate for it to be permissive. The concern that you have for other individuals potentially being involved in the interviews is that it may perhaps have an impact on whether or not the child answers questions and will talk, feel safe, things like that. And so if it's really about making sure that people pay attention to this and consider whether they want to have somebody in there, I think it's a fair point, although I think that happens anyway. And so I imagine that law enforcement would have a point of view about this and about how that impacts the interviews, but I will turn that to them.
So, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Olson, echo those comments that discretion and permissive language is very important to the investigating officer, keeping in mind that these investigations can either, the interviews can either be conducted by DHS as a standalone interviewer or with officer and DHS present. And so it's pretty important, especially young students who may look at the principalhood kind of an advisory figure and they're not necessarily full disclosure or feel comfortable. And so I'll tell you that our officers spend a lot of time kind of evaluating that assessment, whether or not it's for the best. I mean, we obviously would bring them in if it allowed the interview to be more productive than not.
You follow up?
Well, absolutely. Thank you. My concern is predicated on sometimes a DHS interviewer goes into these with a predefined decision and seeks answers to that decision to make certain that their decision is correct. And a criminal that is picked up by police is allowed to have an attorney present to make certain that they're protected. And my concern is that if the child, and I understand where you're coming from, but if a child's brought in there at any age, and if there's not at least two people in there hearing what the child says, then information can be turned and swayed. And I just want to make certain that that never happens, which I know it does. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure that the child is protected. And I can understand that sometimes they would feel uncomfortable with someone else there, but if it was a teacher or someone they were comfortable with throughout, it just makes me want to say that you have to have somebody else in there to make sure that what is being said is in fact said and truly recorded correctly.
If I may, Madam Chair and Vice Chair Olson, again, on behalf of the District Attorneys Association, what is mandated by law is multidisciplinary teams with each of the counties in Oregon. And those multidisciplinary teams are tasked with providing child abuse protocols that apply to all persons who are involved in the investigation of child abuse. And that would include DHS caseworkers, that would include law enforcement officials. And what those protocols hope to do is establish, if you will, ground rules for all people involved in investigations. The people who conduct these investigations must be forensically trained in conducting child interviews. That forensic training in all situations should be geared toward what we call open-ended questioning, that type of questioning that allows a child to disclose whether something did or did not occur, or whether they do or do not know something. And we would love to have the perfect scenario in every child interview. Unfortunately, the reality is that doesn't always occur. And so what the current discretionary language in the statute we hope does is provide that scenario where law enforcement or DHS can go to a school and be given information about an individual child, perhaps a learning disability, perhaps some other type of disability, perhaps be advised that this child is very close to a particular counselor or close to a particular teacher and feels comfortable with that person. And the goal of the existing statute is to make sure that the environment for this child interview is the safest as possible and the most comfortable for the child as possible. And I would agree with our partners here from DHS and law enforcement that if it was mandated that a school personnel be in the room, that may actually hinder a child from being able to provide answers to questions. It may ultimately create problems even down the road in a courtroom if that isn't the best practices for forensic interviews of children, and that type of influence that could or might occur. So I certainly understand your concern, and I think it is an important one. What we hope is that with each one of these MDTs within the county and making sure that folks who are interviewing kids are forensically trained, that we're not going in there with any particular mindset other than an open mind, and an open mind that is intended to get the best facts that you possibly can out of an interview with a child. So I would agree that I believe the existing language that provides that discretion to the investigators really is in the best interest of the children in each individual case. And from our perspective, I think I can speak for both my colleagues here at the table, that's sort of the reason why we would not ask the committee to recommend any sort of amendment that would actually remove that discretion and make it mandatory.
Could you explain then what best practices of a forensic interview are? Does it include recording and videotaping?
That would, again, be dependent on the circumstances. I know in my county in particular, what our child abuse protocol would recommend is that interviews of children be recorded. However, in order to record an interview of any individual, you actually have to have the consent of all parties in the room. That's a separate criminal statute that could otherwise be implicated. And sometimes kids don't want to be recorded. Sometimes that might be more traumatizing than actually just sitting in a room with a person they feel comfortable with and asking questions. So again, that is ultimately left to the discretion of the interviewing officer, whether that is the best thing to do in that situation. And I do not presume to speak for all other counties in Oregon and what their child abuse protocols say, but I do know in Marion County, our recommendation under our child abuse protocol is to record child interviews.
Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Could you remind me how long the existing statute's been in place? I missed that, or if you said it.
If I can have just one moment, I can take a look.
While they're looking, Madam Chair, it was my understanding when I read the bill that the primary reason for having this bill is right now private schools are not included, that an interview could be taking place in a private school. So that's one issue. And then this Department of Human Services shall notify that what Senator Olson is referring to is a statement that is just added. Is that correct?
Senator Anderson, Monis Anderson, Chair Gelser. I think that he's actually referring to a line earlier on in the statute that talks about the...
That's already existing law.
It's already there.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So I think what Senator Olson, Vice Chair Olson, is suggesting is that there would be a change to something that isn't a suggested amendment by the department and actually is law that exists currently.
Yeah, that was kind of the threat, Madam Chair. That was kind of the thrust of my question, just knowing how long we've been living under this regime, absent the extension to private schools.
Right. Well, the
so it's been in place for a while, then.
Yeah, Senator Dembrough, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson. Yes, the actual statute has been in place, I believe, since 1993. I think there were some... kind of to get to your question a little bit more, there's some cases that have come forward. In fact, there was one case that I think has had kind of a ripple effect in the schools, Green versus Camretta. And, you know, that's a more of a recent situation where the court made some findings in the Ninth Circuit, made some findings, and ultimately the case was dismissed at the Supreme Court level. But essentially, what has happened is that there's been attempts in many areas, again, throughout the state, not every school, but many schools, and where this has come up as an issue. And the private school issue actually goes back many years before Green versus Camretta. So it's really what this is attempting to get at is kind of a combination of two different issues. One is about private schools, because the language is pretty clear about public school premises. And for years, that's been an issue for workers attempting to make contact at private schools and being resisted. Then the other piece about notifications is about the Green versus Camretta ruling, I believe. That's something that has impacted our ability to conduct interviews. And I would say it's not just us that is affected. It's affected law enforcement as well. It's impacted law enforcement's ability to interview children. It's impacted their ability to talk to kids and make sure that they're safe as well. So.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I have one, and I'm thinking back to the discussion we had the other day, Senator Olson. The interviews that might take place on school grounds, mm-hmm. are those particularly in depth, or are those more cursory interviews that might lead to something at a child abuse assessment center later on, say in a sex right. abuse case?
Well, Chair Gelser, thank you for the question. Yes, I think that... for all intents and purposes, the point of the protocols that are established that were referred to by Suver, I apologize, is that there's a process for how interviews are supposed to occur. So in point, if information is gathered, they're supposed to stop, and then they're supposed to be conducted at an assessment center. So if a child makes a disclosure about abuse, the investigator is not supposed to continue on in their investigation, right? They're supposed to, and this is part of the training, supposed to stop the interview, take the child or arrange for the child to be at a place that is has been trained in forensic interviewing, and that's generally going to be the assessment centers, so that can be done under a more forensic kind of microscope, if you will. So.
And just as a follow-up to that, forensic is kind of a big word. And when I walk into these places, I don't see forensic. Could you describe a little bit what the environments look like from the eyes of a child that might walk into a Liberty House or an ABC House?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think part of it, the interviewing process itself is about making sure that you're not asking leading questions, that the questions are very open, that children don't feel like they're in a position where they have to talk about anything, right? So, you know, the counselors and the medical staff that are asking questions are trained specifically about being objective, not asking leading questions. The centers themselves, probably different depending upon where you are, but in those that I've been to, they're very child friendly. You know, they're really designed to be situations or places that children feel safe and comfortable and don't feel like they have to talk about anything, and they can say they don't want to talk about it. In fact, that's oftentimes one of the very first kind of opening questions or comments that a person will make in a forensic type of interview is, you don't have to talk to me. If you don't feel comfortable about something, you can say you don't want to talk about it. So, and I don't know if my colleagues here would like to talk about that more. Other input?
Yeah, no, that was a good summary.
Thank you.
I'm sure.
Yes.
Well, you've kind of smoothed over my issue that I had, because you just talked about the fact that they wouldn't be asking leading questions. Mm-hmm. And that's my biggest concern. If it's a police officer or a forensic criminologist in doing the interview, I would assume everything would be above board. I always have concerns when other people come in with a pre-developed thing that, oh, this happened, and I just got to find out how. Mm-hmm. And that's why I said that, you know, if you're a criminal, you get an attorney there with you to protect you. And my biggest concern is who protects the child. Mm-hmm. And if someone is bent on a leading question, then there's no one there to protect the child. That's why I said there shall be someone instead of there may be someone. Mm-hmm. But if under your protocol, if there's a consideration that there has been sexual abuse and the questioning has to stop and somebody else takes over, mm-hmm. then I don't have a problem with it. Didn't know what that process was.
Thank you. Any final questions for this panel? So what do you suppose a timeline, do you have an idea of how close you all are to agreeing to amendments in terms of when I should reschedule?
Well, Chair Gross, I think that, I mean, we were having conversations about this on Friday and today. I think we're really close.
Okay.
I think it's just a couple little tweaks, moving some sentences around, possibly combining them. But I think we probably will have something by tomorrow is my guess.
Oh, so that's, so I think we're about 2 weeks out on the calendar. So mm-hmm. if we put it out, because this does have a subsequent referral to judiciary. I was going to talk to the presiding officer's office and the judiciary chair just about workload to see if everybody's okay. Do we still want to send it down or what happens? I just want to make sure we don't run out of time on the calendar.
Yeah, I think we can have it pretty quickly.
Okay.
So
great.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 101? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 101 and open up a public hearing on, before I steal it, open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 103.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 103 requires the court to make specified findings upon receipt of certain reports in juvenile proceedings when removing a child from a foster home. It permits the court to order the Department of Human Services to maintain the placement of a child.
And we've got Kathy Prouty and Mark McKechnie. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Lori Price.
Hello.
Can I add you to the list?
Please.
All right.
Chair Gelzer, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Prouty, and I am the Permanency Manager for Child Welfare, Department of Human Services, and I am here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 103 this afternoon. So current law requires that when the department plans to has removed a child or plans to remove a child from a foster home where that child has lived at least 12 months or is living there under a permanent foster care agreement, the department must file a report with the court, and the court must then hold a court hearing within 10 days. And the placement of that requirement in statute today requires the department to submit a full court report, and it requires the court to hold a full judicial review. And a full judicial review happens every 6 months for a child. And it does include a number of elements that must be reported on and discussed, such as progress of the parents, how many visits the child has, face-to-face contact, things such as school attendance, and in some cases actually credits towards graduation in certain age groups, the activities that the child has been involved in. And so rather than focusing the hearing on the decision at hand, which is whether the court determines that it's in the child's best interest to remove a child and place the child in another proposed placement, it adds quite a lot of other elements that the court must review. So I want to point out that this bill would not prevent a judge from doing a review that included some or all of these other elements, or that another party to the case could request it. We just think that it should be optional and not a requirement, that the judge or other parties could then make decisions about what else might need to be discussed in that hearing besides just the potential removal or the proposed new placement. The other issue is that the statute today doesn't provide any exception to holding the full judicial review. So perhaps if we've just had one and a few weeks later something happens to the placement and we need to go back, it requires the whole process to be repeated, the report, and then all of the elements to be discussed and the findings to be made in that court hearing. So again, we would support taking it out of or changing the statute so that the full judicial review would not be required in these hearings, and letting the judges decide what information they need to review in order to make their decision. Both the Oregon Judicial Department and YRJ have proposed amendments, and we would like to work with both of those agencies to come to an agreement on an amendment that would be satisfactory to everybody.
And so can you help me understand, if there's been a full review, so you mentioned you go through this whole process and you go through the whole packet, review all this information, and you're now in a foster placement that's been relatively permanent and stable, either because it's been identified as the permanent home for this child or it's been 12 months or longer, what type of thing could happen over the course of a couple of weeks that was not elevated by that full review? Wouldn't you want a full review of what is it that happened to change in a couple of weeks?
Well, Chair Gelser, it could be an abuse allegation. It could be information that we just discovered about certification violations that perhaps we didn't know a couple of weeks ago, or a new incident happened.
So I think one of the concerns, and we talked about this a little bit in my office in Senate Bill 741, the reason that Senator Shields and Representative Stark kind of worked on that legislation was both the difficulty of current caretakers, people who had cared for and had kind of long-term relationships with kids, were having difficulty getting to the adoption committee. And we also heard from many foster families and some youth that if foster families were advocating for kids or elevating their voices, and we heard this a lot in the independent review, that DHS was quickly moving kids, almost as a retaliation or a punishment for speaking up for kids, or sometimes to a youth themselves, that there could be retaliation against a youth for making a complaint about something else that had nothing to do with their placement. We heard from kids who talked about being afraid of raising concerns that were legitimate concerns that could be fixed, but they didn't want to raise them because they were afraid they would be moved out of a placement and maybe separated from their sibling. So the idea of having this full review was a kind of an intentional policy choice in that bill to ensure that it is a high bar, and it's not easy to just go in and move a child or move a youth, that there has to be this full process. I think certainly having an off-ramp if there's an abuse or a child is in danger, which I think there already are other mechanisms for mm-hmm. doing that, but I'm still having a hard time understanding why we would want to make it pretty much just pro forma to be able to move a child out of a stable placement, because we're talking about placements that are very, very long term, and it just seems like it's undoing what we did in 741.
So, Charles Gelzer, I do appreciate that concern, and it certainly is not the intent of this bill to make it easier to move kids. The intent of the bill, and we should only be moving kids from long term placements for reasons of safety concerns or providers are not meeting the needs of children, and we have provided supports and services to no avail. I mean, moving a child from a long-term placement should take a lot of consideration, and that decision should not be made quickly and without a lot of discussion and consideration. It's simply an attempt to give the judges the ability to decide what they need to talk about in the hearing and what they need to provide findings for in the hearing, and to be able to review or not review what they want, as opposed to making a list mandatory of what they have to talk about in a hearing.
So right after the passage of 741, right when it went to effect, there was a case in Jackson County where DHS attempted to immediately move a child in order to basically revoke the current caretaker status, to send the child to a grandmother that the kid didn't know in California. If it were not for the existence of this language in the bill, that child would have been moved, and he's now adopted by this family that had been with him since the day that he was born. And I know there were several legislators that were involved in that conversation, because there was significant effort by DHS to find ways to move this kid and disrupt that current caretaker status. And it was this element that really ended up protecting that child and helping that child now be in a permanent, forever loving family that he's been with since the day he was born.
And Chair Gelzer, if it's the case I'm thinking about, I wasn't personally involved in the case, but I believe our prior director was, and she made sure that that didn't happen when it came to her attention.
But we must be talking about two different cases.
Okay. Fair enough.
So that's my question, though, is how do you protect against that type of abuse from happening? Since we've seen it in the past year, we take this safeguard out. What is to protect the youth from being moved in a retaliatory kind of a way, or to avoid the current caretaker when someone is going to adoption?
Well, Chair Gelzer, I think what prevents that is that the report in the hearing is still required. There's still the ability for the judge to review that decision and decide whether it's in the best interest of the child or not. So we still do have that safeguard in the bill. It's just not making it mandatory that the judge must review every single element of the case.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions? All right, Ms. McKechnie.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelzer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. For 41-plus years, we've been representing children and parents in the juvenile dependency system in the trial and appellate courts. I'm here today to offer our position in support of the changes in Senate Bill 103. As you may recall, it was our organization who brought forth Senate Bill 741, and we actually worked for two sessions until it was passed unanimously in 2015. And I want to, since the first time I've been in front of the committee, I think since that happened, I want to thank you all for your support of Senate Bill 741 and for the three of you on this committee who sponsored the bill, for your sponsorship. It was a very important change, and we certainly, you know, when we work so hard to pass a piece of legislation, one of the fears that you have in the future is that somebody will try to undo what you've accomplished. So we take that very seriously. And we've looked at this bill and consider that it maintains the integrity of what was needed in Senate Bill 741, which is to first erect a speed bump to prevent precipitous placement changes and to allow the court to review a proposed change or a change soon after the fact if that's necessary. And we've conveyed to DHS that we're generally satisfied with the way Senate Bill 103 is drafted, except for the specific best interest finding on page 2, found in lines 21 and 22. And it would require the court in these hearings to make a finding that it's in the best interest of the child or ward that the proposed placement or the placement that DHS has recently made is in the best interests of the child. But the purpose of Senate Bill 741 was to examine whether removal from the current caretaker was in the best interest of the child. So we think that we can maintain the integrity of that intent by changing the language to require the court to find whether the removal of the or proposed removal of the child or ward from the foster home in this section is in the best interest of the child or ward. And we certainly see the concerns expressed by DHS and the courts that sometimes a full-blown review hearing, depending on timing and other factors, could be an inefficient use of time. But we think that with this change, and certainly we're willing to discuss other amendments, I think there may be a couple other ideas floating out there, that as long as the hearing focuses on the critical issue of whether removing the child from the long-term placement is in the child or ward's best interest, that then the discretion of the court to decide how much information to ask for should be somewhat left up to the discretion of the court and determined more on a case-by-case basis. To sort of respond to some of the earlier questions, I think one of the things that we've found, and you may be aware, there was a task force on juvenile dependency representation that met during the interim, and one of the things that came out during that process is there's a wide variety of practices across the state in terms of how frequent review hearings are held. So in some counties, it may be that they are routinely held, in most cases, every 6 months, which is the minimum requirement. And in some counties, as frequently as monthly, based on the local culture and the preference of the court and the availability on their docket to do so. And most counties fall somewhere in between, where an average might be more like 3 or 4 months in many counties. So it's hard to say how long it would be or how long from the last review hearing or until the next review hearing when this particular issue might come up, depending on, among other things, which county the case is in. So I think that would weigh into the consideration of the court in terms of how much information they want based on how long it's been since the last review hearing. If they've reviewed other factors in the case a month earlier when this issue comes before them, they may want to focus on solely the placement issue. If it's been 5 months, they may want more information about the child generally. So bottom line is we're comfortable with the changes as long as the amendment to focus on the best interest finding is made part of the bill. Thank you.
And just to be clear, then it would be explicit. Basically, there would have to be an explicit statement of why is this removal being made and demonstrating that removal, not just the new placement, but the actual removal itself.
Chair Gelser, correct. We're asking that the court make a finding specifically on whether DHS's removal or proposed removal from the long-term placement, the current caretaker, is or is not in the child's best interests.
Other questions for this panel? And has Representative Stark been engaged in your discussions of developing this since it was his bill?
Chair Gelser, not that I'm aware of. I don't know if Director Psyche or anybody else in the department discussed this bill with him. I did not personally.
Chair
Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Lori Price. I'm Deputy Director of the Child Welfare Program here in Oregon. I am here today just to ask you to give us a bit more time to work with our partners at OJD and at YRJ to work on some amendments to this bill. And certainly, Senator Gelser, your comment is well taken. We can engage with Representative Stark in these conversations as well.
Okay. Thank you very much. Sure. Anything further? Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on Senate Bill 103? Nope, gone. All right, we're closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 103 and opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 105.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 105 requires independent residence facilities for minors to be licensed, certified, or authorized by the Department of Human Services under laws regulating the child caring agencies. Declares emergency and effective on passage.
Thank you. And we've got Harry Gilmore. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm Harry Gilmore. I manage the Children's Care Licensing Unit at Department of Human Services. And I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 105. This is a legislative concept that we developed at DHS, and it's really a technical fix to, well, it does two things. The first thing is it is designed to better delineate and distinguish child caring agencies from other types of care facilities that are licensed or certified by DHS or the Oregon Health Authority. ORS 418-205 to 418-327 deals specifically with child caring agencies, the licensing and oversight of those agencies by DHS. And there's a separate set of statutes that deal with other types of care facilities, more specifically facilities that care for and treat individuals with developmental disabilities, the elderly, folks in community-based care settings, and other populations. However, if you look at the definition of residential facility in those ORS 443 statutes, it could be construed or it could be argued that they also describe child caring agencies. And so this bill is an attempt to make a clear distinction between those facilities that are designed for other populations and child caring agencies that are covered by the 418 statutes. The other thing the bill does is there's a particular section of the child caring agency statutes that deals specifically with a subcategory of child caring agencies called independent residence facilities. And these programs are part of the definition of child caring agencies. However, the statute that specifically describes them points to the 443 statutes as the statutes that they're licensed under. And we don't believe that's intentional because they're part of the definition of child caring agencies. It seems logical that they would be licensed under the child caring agency statutes. And so this bill would make that technical change to point to the 418 statute when for the licensing and oversight of those particular types of facilities. As we've scrutinized the bill a little bit more since it was put out, we realize there's a couple of technical changes that some areas where it needs greater clarification. One example of that is the 418 statute, and this actually isn't part of our bill, but it's something that could be addressed by our bill. The 418 statute that deals with independent residence facilities uses the term minor. This doesn't align very well with the terminology used throughout the 418 statute, where it talks about children, and child in care is the terminology used, which specifically means people up to and including age 20. And a minor is generally understood to mean people up to the age of 17. So one of the amendments that we propose is replacing that term minor with either child in care or other terminology that aligns more with how a child is described throughout the rest of the statute. We don't think that these will have any result in any substantive change in our practice or how we review or license or oversee child caring agencies, but we do believe it will eliminate some ambiguity and the potential for confusion in the law. And with the amendments, it'll correct this issue around the definition of a minor versus a child in care. And that's really the extent of the bill in a nutshell. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
So I have a question. I still am really confused. What is the problem that this bill, what has happened that we don't want to have happened that we're fixing by passing legislation?
Chair Gelser, really this, we were reviewing some proposed legislation during the 2015 session. And that's when we were really scrutinizing the ORS 443 statutes to determine whether the proposed bills would have an impact on child caring agencies specifically. And it was through that review that we detected the fact that the 443 statutes, a close reading of the definition of residential care facility in those statutes, could easily be applied to child caring agencies. And we've never used those statutes to govern how we license and regulate child caring agencies at DHS. And so the feeling was that that was not intentional, that the 443 statutes is really aimed at facilities that serve folks with developmental disabilities, community-based care for adults, and other types of facilities. So it was really, it was out of that overlap between the two statutes where we saw that it could be clearer and it could be confusing to somebody reading the statute not familiar with our practice. They can easily think that the 443 statutes apply specifically to child caring agencies because of the way the term residential care facility is defined in the 443 statute. It's really a technical change. As I said, we haven't relied on the 443 statutes at DHS for licensing child caring agencies, but we're trying to avoid any liability that could come from somebody arguing that we should be looking to those statutes for child caring agencies when there's, in fact, a whole other section of statute, the 418 series, that deals more specifically and directly with child caring agencies.
So maybe another way to ask the question, it's hard for me to vote on something if I don't understand what it does.
Right.
What is the really great thing that will happen because we pass this bill, and what is the really terrible thing that will happen if we don't?
Nothing terrible will happen. It means that we'll continue to live with the ambiguity that we've been living with for some time now. If it does pass, then it'll remove the potential for confusion and ambiguity in the law in the future.
And, Senator Gelser, it's my understanding the way I'm reading the fact sheet that is much easier to understand. But we could be sued if someone else wanted to use the 443.4 statute, taking the child care agency in that context rather than the 418.205 statute. Did I get that right?
Senator Mona Anderson, Chair Gelser, I suppose it is a concern. I mean, someone could make that argument because of the way the definition is construed in 443. There's a list of specific exclusions from the 443 statute, and it includes other types of facilities that serve children, county-run juvenile facilities, and we'd just be simply adding child caring agencies to that list of exclusions. Mm-hmm.
And is Dee Dee okay with this? Because sometimes in the Dee Dee statutes, an individual is not intended to just be an adult. It stretches all the way down to the child. So have Bruce and Lilia weighed in on this?
DD is tracking the statute, tracking the bill, I should say. They haven't raised concerns specifically. I have not had a specific conversation with the folks at DD. I do know that the 443 statute does delineate facilities for developmentally disabled adults and children. So those are separate from child caring agencies, and I don't think this bill will impact that distinction.
So I guess then one question after that. Since the aging side doesn't put elderly people in care, since they don't meet that definition of being under the age of 21, since they're like 80,
right.
And DD is carved out, which would be the only one that's under the age of 21, who is it exactly that we're excluding when we...
Well, part of the issue is the way that 443 defines residential care facility. Yeah, part of the definition is six or more socially dependent individuals. And it doesn't distinguish children or adults. And someone could argue that is generally describes our child care and agencies, in particular residential treatment facilities, homeless and runaway shelters, other types of facility-based care that are part of the array of what's covered under the child care and agency statute. So it doesn't specifically say adults when it's talking about residential care facilities in the 443 statute.
Okay.
And so really that's the specific part of the 443 that we're trying to address. And one of the amendments, I think we've been a bit overbroad in the way we've excluded child caring agencies. And that's one of the things that if the bill goes forward that we would refine more with an amendment to specifically target that part of the definition.
So the definition of socially dependent, that is, are foster children covered in the definition of socially dependent, or are those?
Socially dependent is not defined in the statute. So applying, a general definition to that term, the feeling was it could be argued that foster kids and other kids that are served in child care and agencies mm-hmm. could fit that description generally.
Okay. And do you have the amendments that you want?
Chair Gelser, we're working on it. We're not quite there. Some of them we've nailed down, and others still need a little time to refine.
All right. Any other questions here? Thank you. Lori, did you have something to add? All right. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on Senate Bill 105? You sure? All right. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 105. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 506.
Madam Chair, Senate and members of the committee, Senate Bill 506 accepts public and private officials from child and elder abuse reporting requirements when the official learns of abuse through information official reasonably believes is already known to law enforcement or Department of Human Services, declares emergency, and is effective on passage.
Great. We have only one person signed up, Katie Suver from ODAA.
Good afternoon again. For the record, Chair, my name is Katie Suver with the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The proposed amendments to Senate Bill, or with Senate Bill 506, to the Elder Abuse Mandatory Reporting Statute are troublesome to the District Attorneys Association for this reason only, and that is that what we believe the public policy behind both elder abuse and child abuse mandatory reporting statutes to be is an extremely broad-based, over-inclusive group of people who, if they reasonably suspect abuse, are mandated to report it. And what this would effectively do is provide a mechanism that an individual who is a public or private official who falls under the statute may believe they don't have to report. In other words, it restricts or narrows, I think, what the legislature saw from a public policy standpoint should actually be broadened and expanded. So the DA's Association would object to the amendment for the reason that instead of making a report, an individual may actually spend that much time or even more time figuring out if they actually believe they don't have to report. So what we hope with all these mandatory reporting statutes is that the phone gets picked up by someone, they make the report, and then those agencies who have this information can verify that they already have the information, whether it be the Department of Human Services with any elder abuse section or a law enforcement agency. And then alternatively, if it hasn't yet been reported, then that satisfies the requirement of the report. So mainly because it, again, it provides that restriction, that's what we're concerned with.
Great, thank you. Are there questions?
Who do you represent again?
Sure. Chair Yeltsin, Senator Monis Anderson, with the Oregon District Attorneys Association.
Okay.
We received something from the Oregon State Bar.
And Senator Anderson, I did see that comment that was submitted by the bar. Obviously, the bar represents my world, which is
yes.
Attorneys. We know that there are hundreds of other individuals who fall under the mandatory reporting statute. I do understand the bar's concerns, but they, I guess what I would say is the DA's Association doesn't share those concerns because we are in the business of hoping anyone and everyone sees this as I'm going to report this and let the agencies who have the information and need the information do from that point forward what needs to be done with the case. So I did read the comments that were submitted on behalf of the attorneys in Oregon, and because my world sort of revolves more around just individuals as opposed to limited to attorneys, the DA's Association maintains this position.
Well, the only comment they said is that they would suggest that the language used in the bill just be made parallel to the language for child abuse reporting in ORS 419B. And I was wondering, if we didn't do that, what are the ramifications?
Chair Gelser, Senator Monis Anderson, I would agree that if this committee believed that the amendments under Senate Bill 506 were appropriate, that is, took an opposite position from the DA's Association, that whatever amendments are there should parallel from a training perspective the language of the child abuse reporting statute as well. So I certainly agree with the standpoint of the Oregon State Bar Association. And we just don't agree with their position, but I definitely agree with the rationale behind their opinion.
Thank you. Thank you. Susan, did you want to come up?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Susan Graby with Oregon State Bar, and thank you. And I do appreciate the comments that were made. There's some of the comments that we actually share as well. The genesis of this proposal is to, we do believe that the reporting requirement should be a broad requirement. However, if you go, my understanding is the intent behind this bill was to make sure the language with the elder abuse statute, which was passed just a few cycles ago, is consistent with the exemption to the double reporting requirement that, for example, judges have in the courtroom. And so if the bill were to go forward, it would need to be amended, and our view is it should be consistent.
So neither of you support the bill as currently written, or your organizations?
No.
That's correct.
And you might be able to if there are amendments. You will not be able to even if there are amendments. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
The DA's Association, again, for the reasons that I stated, would not agree to the amendments.
Okay. Got it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other questions for the panel? Senator Denbrough has a question.
Actually, not to either of you, but to you, Madam Chair. Do we know where this bill came from?
Not,
it was a Judiciary Committee bill I saw.
Not really. Okay. It was hard to figure out, so I thought if we posted it, the people that loved the bill would come forward for it.
And right. They didn't.
So once these two individuals leave, then the proponent will be there or conspicuously absent. Is that correct?
There's nobody else signed up.
Thank you.
Conspicuously absent.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 506? Nope. Seeing none. All right. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 506. And it's 2:10 and we're done, which is exciting. I don't know if we get to count those as rollover minutes.
I'm right. Sure you will try to, Madam Chair, at some point.
Thank
you. Are you going to kill
Congress? Let's get out of the hearing first. I don't know what's getting scheduled next yet, but we are adjourned. Sorry. Getting scheduled next yet, but we are adjourned.